This is the Resident Review, a plastic surgery podcast. I'm Rose Trotta, and today I have the honor of being joined by Dr. Jennifer Walden to discuss one of my favorite topics as I'm kind of nearing the end of my residency. So she's going to talk with me about the journey of starting a practice, including something that we don't get a ton of exposure to in our early residency years, and that's the incorporation of MediSpot techniques and non-invasive procedures to augment a thriving surgical practice. So much for joining me today, Dr. Walden.
Thank you so much for having me, Rose. I'm honored to be here. Thanks.
Yeah. So a little bit about Dr. Walden. She was born and raised in Austin, Texas, went to undergraduate at the University of Texas at Austin, which I think I saw you were a Pi Beta Phi. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Hello. I was also a Pi Beta Phi.
All right. Angel. Your wow. Angel later.
Yes, absolutely. Always fun to see a fellow sorority sister here. And then she went to medical school at the University of Texas Medical Branch, UTMB, followed by plastic surgery residency there at UTMB as well, and then an aesthetics fellowship at Manhattan Ear, Eye, and Throat in New York City. Yeah. She's built an incredibly large practice, comprehensive, including a full-scale cosmetic surgery practice and 3 medical spas, 2 in Austin and 1 in New York City. She's an active member of the American Society for Aesthetic Plastic Surgery and the American Society of Plastic Surgeons. And Dr. Walden was also recently elected president of the Aesthetic Society in April of 2022. She's the first female president of the society. She's been featured in numerous television and print media sources as an expert in surgical and non-surgical plastic surgery techniques. So we are so excited to talk with you today and hear more about your practice.
Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. That's amazing.
So I was really interested, you know, in your journey to this kind of practice, because like I said, it's not something we get a lot of exposure to, and how to go from this academic setting into kind of owning your own business. So did you always know that this was the kind of practice style that you wanted to end up in? And did you set yourself up for it, or did your journey kind of lead you there?
I think a little bit of both. I knew I wanted to be a surgeon early, like junior high, high school, and really always excelled. So I went with what I was good at, which was like anatomy and physiology. So I ended up going to medical school and residency at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston, Texas. And my chair was Linda Phillips, who is a strong advocate for women in surgery and just mentorship in general. So she's been a lifelong mentor to me. But she really early on got me interested in plastic surgery as a med student. I ended up matching into that program and staying in Texas. You know, I went to her early in residency and decided I wanted to do aesthetic surgery. I was interested in it being female. I had, you know, very similar characteristics as the average aesthetic surgery patient. I understood what they were coming from, that sort of thing. And so I went to her early and she supported me. So one of the first times I ever realized that I wanted to do a fellowship in aesthetic surgery was, it was in 2001, and it was the month after 9/11. I was doing, we at Galveston, we would do a rotation at Dr. Jim Stuzen and back then Dr. Tom Baker, who's now deceased, practice. And they were really some pioneers, especially Tom Baker in aesthetic surgery, like one of the first plastic surgeons to develop like the croton and phenol chemical peel, modern facelifting techniques with smash flaps, all of that good stuff. And so we, as residents at Galveston, because we didn't get a lot of facial aesthetics, we went there when we were residents, early in residency, which is a good, smart thing to do, is find those things out early in residency. And it just opened my eyes. I loved it because it was the month. It was October 1st. I flew out there on a flight with no other people on the plane. It was right after 9/11. And it was a little slow because the people had stopped traveling and a lot of people flew in for surgery. But during this time, I had a lot of time to research aesthetic surgery. They had a library there of videotapes. And so I'd pop in a VHS videotape every night and watch like different people performing facelift surgery, rhinoplasty. And that's where I learned kind of all the names, the faces, the surgery procedures. And it was there I really decided to do aesthetic surgery fellowship. And there weren't as many as there are now. We have many ASAPS endorsed fellowships now. But back then I realized I wanted to be a New Yorker. I had a I had a real calling to New York. I couldn't help after 9/11, but I was really drawn to the city. And I've been like that ever since. I've been married to the city. But I matched into Manhattan Eye, Ear, and Throat Hospital, and Sherelle Astins was chairman there. And I learned, and that just opened up my world. So no, we're moving from, you know, Austin to Galveston to New York City is a total culture shock. And it was just an amazing, you know, thing for me. I mean, this was at the height of Sex in the City. And I was like 28, 29 year old single woman moving in New York City. I was living the dream. And so it really was like that for me. And I had several girlfriends who were not married yet, and they lived in the city. They'd already lived there and worked there for years. And so it was a fun time. That was a real, but most importantly, you know, I had my own fellows clinic, and I did facelifting, eyelid surgery, rhinoplasty, breast surgery. And that was there I got to kind of gain the foundation for which I was going to grow for the rest of my career, my surgical career. And I had the hands-on experience that you want to get in a fellowship. And that basically was a foundation for setting and realizing that I wanted to go into private practice. And in one of the defining moments in my, I might be getting ahead of myself, but one of the defining moments of me deciding, you know, aesthetics was 100% for me. And I wanted to be a part of organized aesthetic plastic surgery was attending my first aesthetic society meeting, which was like the spring of the year that I did the fellowship at Baker Stuyzen, the 1 month fellowship. And it was just opened my eyes. It was like the first time I'd ever been to a big meeting. It was the first time I'd ever been in a sided exhibit hall. And it had, this is before Botox and filler and before Cool Sculpting. This is before all of that. And so what we had to look at was like surgical instrumentation and all sorts of skincare. I was taking samples from every table. It was like I was a kid in a candy store, literally, at this first meeting. But on a more serious side, I remember at that meeting opening up an aesthetic surgery journal and seeing an all-male masthead of the editors. And I just had a fleeting thought of, I wish I could be the first female president. I mean, but someone will be there before me. Like, there'll be no way. Like, I'm so young. But that is just something I remember from back then. And lo and behold, here I am.
And thank you for being that for everyone else who's coming up, because it'll be nice for all the other young women who are at those meetings to now see a female on that panel and, you know, heading the meeting and all of that. That's how we do it. That's how we build up.
Yeah. And we have, you know, like Melinda Hawes is coming up after me. It's not just me. We're coming on with a vengeance. So Melinda Hawes is after me as president. And then several years later, Tracy Pfeiffer. So we definitely broke the glass ceiling.
Love to see it. We love that. So what were some of the biggest challenges I think you experienced getting there? Like, are there things that you wish you would have had help getting to different places, or did you have really good mentorship helping you?
I was lucky. I had good mentorship, you know, through my early formative years with Dr. Phillips and then my early professional career with Dr. Astin. So I think I was in a good situation for that. I guess I kind of, you groom your own future, right? So you kind of curate your own future. And I think that's important to remember, even when you're like in your 20s and early 30s, you really do shape your future. And so I think it's important to, you know, gain mentorship early on. I know you hear that a lot, but we're trying to enhance, you know, kind of inclusion and diversity within the aesthetic society and have mentorship programs for people here in underserved like departments where there is no department of plastic surgery at their hospital or academic center. And so we're trying to enhance the visibility of our private practice doctors to become mentors. But I feel like that helped me a lot. As far as challenges, you know, I think the biggest challenge to me probably would be, I never got married. I'm 50 and I don't have any desire to right now, but, you know, maybe when I'm like 79 or something, but, right now, you know, I was one of those people that was like, I need to focus on my residency. And then I'd be like, well, I need to focus on my fellowship. And then on that, I was like, I need to focus on passing the boards. And I always found something else to focus on, but I think it was because that's what was my passion. Right. And so And I have a hard time splitting up, like half my passion is going to you and half my passion is going to you. So I really think that's hard. I mean, it's hard for men, but for women, it's hard because we're, that's when we are of like prime childbearing age. That's when most people, my friends started to get married and I felt so young still. I was still like in like late in med school, early in residency. I had matured in some ways, maybe they had. And so to me, I think it was the delay in childbearing was rough. But I kept thinking one day, you know, Mr. Wright's going to come along and I'll have a family and it's just going to be like that. And that's going to be the easy part type deal. And I'm in the hard part is what I thought. Not I'm always in the hard part. Right. But okay. What happened was, you delay it and you delay it. And so to me, what really was hard is like, say, you know, I was in New York City and I had a thriving practice, but I got into my late 30s and I really started to feel the need to have children. And my OB-GYN said, you need to do it like now, or it's never going to happen really. Like, so I, at that point in time, I went to NYU and Jamie Griffo was my doctor. He's in, like a world renowned fertility doctor. And I realized, you know, like I didn't even know it, but I realized that I was going to have to do IVF no matter what, like no matter what. My FSH was like way high. I'd probably burn through my hormones, you know, just working so hard, my hormones were burnt, everything was burnt. So that was, I think, the toughest challenge, the biggest like roof come crashing through is that, oh my God, you know, like, it's not going to be like I planned. That became the biggest blessing. I did IVF and I gave birth to twin sons. So because of that, like they've been the biggest blessing of my life. Out of that, I've grown, I matured, I moved to Austin, I built an empire, like seriously. So it was a good time to move, but it was because of them. It was because I gave birth to my sons and I literally couldn't do it all. I realized I hit a wall. Like you can work hard and do great in school and do great in residency, but when you throw children in the mix, and it is incredibly hard to do without help. So that was my reckoning. You know, I just realized I needed help and I needed family help, not just like paid help, because I realized I needed family. And so I moved back a year after I gave birth to my sons. And so I think those were the hardest times of my career is kind of realizing the work-life balance wasn't going to just magically happen. And you wake up and you think, did I wait too late? And so that's just something I think men and women think about, but I think, you know, female surgeons really, I mean, we talk about it more now, it's more accepted now, but I think it is important to think about.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And we've had conversations like that before on this podcast as well, as in my residency and among my friends. I think surgeons specifically, we go through this track of life where everything is like one step after the next. We're just looking at our next goal.
Exactly.
And we do. Okay, if I keep working hard, I'm going to get to that next goal. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going to work out because it's just, that's the pathway.
That's the way we work.
Right. You don't think that, you know, maybe it won't, or maybe you have to do something different to get there.
Yeah. Different pathway than you thought was going to happen.
Yeah.
I definitely. I mean, I looked back and I got lab results back when early in the days of when I was going to do IVF, and I got lab results back and I was like 39, and you know, they were like, whoa. And so I had to like realize like, well, when, like at what point in time? Cause you know, the doctor was like, you don't worry, like, don't fret. We're going to help you. But like, you probably like tore through your adrenal glands, like 5 or 6 years ago. Like, this is a long time ago. And I was like, oh my God, should I have done this last year? Like, should I have done this 3 months ago? And he's like, oh my, he goes, no. This is like you working, you know, your genetics. So like my mom and my sister went through early menopause and I didn't know, like, I just didn't ever, or they've told me, I didn't pay attention. It meant nothing to me when I was young,
right?
But I had a genetic predisposition. And then I worked so hard and wore through, you know, hormones and mm-hmm. that sort of thing. Kind of the wear and tear of life and stress, chronic stress. Right. And so I think, he was like, no, this is like years ago, Jennifer, like, don't don't second guess yourself. Don't right. think it could have been a different a month ago or last year.
Right.
But that was very hard for me. That was just because I was thinking back of like, well, gosh, did I do something wrong? Like, should
that's
I not?
How we're built.
Yeah. See. Yeah. But that's exactly how we're built. We're built to be task oriented. You know, we're like you said, we're goal driven people. And it's funny you say that because I was doing another interview today. And they were like, so, you know, what is your next goal with your, and I was like, oh my God, I have so reached that. Like I said, my goal is to let those med spas run and I'm going to go home and be with my boys until they go off to college. That's my goal. Like after this year. Yeah. So
I love that.
It took me that long. And but that's kind of, you know, I mean, and we can get there, but that's kind of one of the reasons why I built that part of my practice too.
Yeah. And I think that's a huge thing that's one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, because again, like I said, we don't get a lot of experience talking about that. We're built as in training to always be looking at the next huge thing. And the next huge thing is not always like the next appointment or the next anything. Sometimes the next huge thing is being able to spend time with your family,
building your life so that
you can do the things you love.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. It took me a while to get there. Like, so it's really been in the last like 5 years, probably, that I've gotten to that point in my life where I was able to like metabolize those words of wisdom that people give you. They give you. But when you're like early in your career, you're like, yeah, I get it. Okay, I'll get there. Yeah. Okay. But now
so I'm accurate.
I mean, at least that's the way I was.
It's so accurate.
Like, yeah. You're just trying to sabotage me. Get out of here. Go
ahead. I can keep going. It's fine.
I can keep going like this for a long time.
Yeah.
It's only been in like the past 5 years or so that I really have taken to heart of like, you know, life, we have got one life to live. And so I want to make the most of it with my children and I want to be there for them when they have their highs and their lows. And I have to really put myself in their shoes and think back. And I do, I try to walk their walk and think back, how important was this to me in junior high? Well, this was really, really important that my parents went to this. So I've got to do that. Even though like you're operating on someone in one hour, but the next hour you're going to go to a Valentine's party in their classroom or something like that, to them that was a big deal. Mm-hmm. And I try to do that. And that's what I've just tried to do the whole time, is remember how important things were to me as a child.
That's incredible. I love hearing this. It honestly just gives me so much hope that there's like normal life out there, along with being able to like pursue passions, like do things that you love.
For sure.
So I guess diving a little bit more into your practice that you've built, How did you choose like what non-invasive modalities to incorporate in your practice? How do you choose how to set it up and who to run it?
Yeah, I mean, so when I moved to Austin, like I said, I had this big transition and life reckoning, and I moved to Austin. What was kind of a very emotional roller coaster and a hard to figure out, like a wow, you know, like I'm moving my practice kind of early career, like what is this going to do? It turned out to be a positive. And I think the message out of that is like, I think if you put your family first, things end up working out. Like, so I think when you put like money first or your credit account or your investments first, I really think you can get screwed up that way in the brain. And if you put your family first, meaning your children or your spouse, I think things tend to work out for the best. And so what I did is I just said, I got to do it for my children. Like they need to grow up near their grandma. They need to grow up near my sister, my brothers. They need to have a male influence. Mm-hmm. So I put them first, and what ended up being a massive positive. So I got here in Austin, Texas. It's a little different than it was in New York. New York is they're heavy on the dermatologists. Do a lot of injecting and laser, but they're not as many medical spas that are, at least back then when I moved here, that delegated to providers. The derms are very much, it was their territory to inject, right? Mm-hmm. And that's because there's so many amazing dermatologists in New York City, one on every block. So they had the stake in that. But you move to a city in Texas that doesn't really have a university medical center, or at least they didn't, it's all private practitioners here. And there are a lot of people, you know, there were people practicing outside of their scope that were like family doctors running small surgical centers and putting implants in and also having med spas. So if you have a good quality plastic surgeon owned medical spa in certain parts of the United States, which vis-a-vis was Austin, Texas, then it's going to grow. Like people are going to go there. Like they wanted that. There was a need there. And so while there were already some medical spas owned by plastic surgeons here doing very well, I think there was in Austin, it was growing at that, it's still growing a lot, but this was in the years where it was like the most growing city year after year in like US News and World Report. It was top city for growth. And mm-hmm. so it was just kind of right place at a right time. Austin was booming. Everybody's moving here, tech industries and that sort of thing. And so everyone was moving here. And I think it was the right time at the right place. So I had some key staff at that point in time that had joined my team, and they knew more about running a med spa than I did. And I'll be honest with you. And I brought them in, and that we worked together. They needed me. I needed them. They needed they wanted a plastic surgeon of good repute, like to be their medical director. They needed that. They wanted that feather in their cap. Right. Mm-hmm. And I needed to kind of learn the logistics and running a medical spa, because I was always in New York City where the dermatologist did all the laser and the injectables. And so, we built a med spa together, you know, as a team. That was in like maybe 2015, 2016, that really expanded. And then at some point in time, I realized I still, you know, like when you have unfinished business. Like I felt like in life, I felt like I had unfinished business and there was a loop to close. And I loved New York. And so I went back to New York, and I ended up buying a medical spa in New York City, because I that's where my kids were born. You know, I just love it. I love the city. And I still do. I still do. I'm glad I don't live there anymore, but I love it. I love visiting it.
Yeah.
So that's the story of the growth there.
That's wild. It seems like it all happens, but it all just comes to fruition, but it's so much hard work and
yeah,
you can see how I built it step by step.
Yeah. I mean, it's not easy. Like, it's not like, I can sit here and talk about this and it sounds so amazing, but like, truthfully, it is a ton of hard work. And the thing about being the owner of your business is basically you're never really off. And, mm-hmm. and I mean, so that's a caveat for people, you know, you guys, you're millennials and even younger and that sort of thing. And like, so I don't jump right into it is my advice. Like, do not jump right into anything like that, or you'll just get stuck with harnessed with a lot of debt. I think going into practice with someone else or a group is a good idea, or a hybrid like academic private practice. I think that's good. I could have never done this, what I'm doing now, when I stepped out of fellowship. Never, right. And I would have just bombed. Like, I just didn't even know what a P&L she was. At least now there's like MBA programs. There was no business acumen or no mm-hmm. business at all in medical school or residency, not even a mention of a MD MBA. So, and I didn't ever do that, but like I learned just through grit and hard work. And so that it's not easy, but it's just something that's there, right? It's something that I think that we as plastic surgeons need to keep a hold of and not let it slip out of our hands into the hands of non-qualified practitioners, the OB-GYNs, the medical doctors, the nurses. No offense to any of them. I just think we're well suited to be at the top of the heap running things because we know how to deal with each and every complication.
Right.
Non-invasive. That's what we do. We're well, very well suited because we are the ones that operate on the facial anatomy and the breast, and we know the buttock, you know, all that stuff. So I think it's important we keep a stronghold on that.
Yeah, I think we have that granular knowledge that helps when overseeing all that. So one of my other questions was, how do you choose who to bring into your practice and who to allow to do certain things and what techniques to use when you have such like a broad spectrum, essentially?
I mean, okay, so I think one of the biggest challenges is HR or staffing, right? So mm-hmm. one of the biggest challenges is the hiring, the firing, the management of staff. Because you think you're in control as a surgeon and you think you know everything and you don't, like you just miserably don't. And so I think when you go into private practice, you have to get a team that like, which represents what your core values are, what your mission is. And they usually are somewhat like you in personality or it'll clash. And that's really hard to do because you can't control it. Like you can't control what person A says to your patient. Like you can say, this is how I'd like you to approach these consults, but you can't control what comes out of their mouth. And you have to be patient, you have to be kind, and you have to find people that you really mesh with. And I think that's the hardest thing of all, and set expectations, and you got to pay them and be responsible for them and give them benefits, you know, which is, or else they're going to go somewhere else and be hired by someone else. So there are a lot of things with staffing that I think are very challenging. And I think it's just because as surgeons, we think we're in control of the situation, and we really, really, truly are not. You know, a lot of times you have to rely on your practice manager or, you know, your surgical coordinator, and you have to trust them and rely on them that they're going to do the right thing, and they're going to say the right things to the staff if the staff asks about XYZ, because they really field a lot of your they can make your life a lot better, right? Mm-hmm. They can make your life a lot better if you have the right people for you that can just make you or break you, literally. Like, and so I'm sure you, like, I think as residents we know that we kind of have a feeling of like, yeah, the head nurse on 6, you got to be nice to her because she can make your life misery, right? So it's the same concept, right? So it's just in real, it's like your life, and they, you don't rotate off. It's right. Your practice, it's yours, and you own it. Same, like I kind of always think back to like the sending of the pizzas up to off floor 6 for the nurses, because you really want them to be happy. You want them to like be your ambassadors, and you don't rotate away from them. You don't rotate away from your patients either. Right. You know, it's not as if you have a difficult patient, like, well, I'm going to be on craniofacial next month, so right, I can get through this. No, that's not how it works. And so I think basically just forming the best team possible. I've always tried to get the people that are the best at what they do that kind of match my core values. And like I said, my mission, which is like, it's really like a serious one. It's like, I'm serious about what I do. So I want them to excel and be good at what they do and have a culture of patient safety and just a safe space. So a safe space for our patients to come and to talk about what they want done, that they don't feel judged upon in. And that means, you know, people come to me because, and they will tell me, I come to you because it's all female practice. Mm-hmm. That's why I came to you. You know, obviously I'm coming to you because of your surgical skills, but the fact that it was all female practice led me to you because there are other people they can pick. You know, there are a lot of female surgeons. And so that's a big deal to me. And so I like to kind of protect that and make it safe for them. And patient privacy is a huge aspect to me. Patient privacy is so huge. And I don't tolerate like talking about the patients or laughing about or social media use that's not approved. Nothing like that can happen because of the trust they're putting in you. And so those are kind of my core things there. And I just try to find team members that are similar, and they end up kind of being similar in person. I think people end up being similar in personality to their boss, they can identify with it, right, or maybe someone in their family is like you. And so they know how to work well with you. Mm-hmm. You remind me of my dad. I know how to deal with my dad. Right. So like, and so my staff tend to have a good sense of humor. They're witty, they're dry. And when they need to like get it out, they can get out. I don't care. But at the end of the day, you know, and if they have a problem, they know they can come to me and they can tell me what the problem is, and we'll kind of work through it together. But they know that I'm there, and I'll listen to them and that sort of thing.
That's really cool. And you can, it's very palpable, like the culture that you promote and like the values that you have. I can, like, but just by talking to you, you can tell that like the loyalty is very important to you. And you know, you have a strong like presence and a strong leadership presence that I think probably allows them to also be very good leaders and have everything together.
Yeah. And I think it's like just trying to do things by example. And one book I talk about, I got from one of the past presidents, is called The Servant Leader. I think everyone should read it. The Servant Leader, like, especially if you're in a group or an association or whatnot, is just learning to lead by example, kind of learn to lead by example and servitude, not always thinking about yourself. Right. So I try to apply that. Like I try to apply that in the ascetic society, right, where you don't really put your interests as first. That would be counterintuitive. You have to put the right organization and the membership and the board. But in practice, I try to set the tone by working hard. And, you know, I mean, I've heard staff say, yeah, Dr. Walden works harder than anybody else. So So I need you to stay and help, you know. So my staff kind of know that. And I think it's kind of, I try to just kind of lead by example and that this is serious to me. And we all work hard, but then we go home and play hard, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I definitely respect that. And I have more questions about, like, more specifically the playbook that you were talking about and how to set up a practice. Yeah. About kind of the journey of getting to starting your practice and creating this kind of empire in which you have your surgical practice and then your medi spas, and you're creating this wonderful culture around it. But diving more into like the playbook, like you said, of creating a successful medi spa, using all these different modalities and kind of delegating responsibilities here and there, how are you able to decide what non-invasive modalities to incorporate into your practice? What's important, and how do you decide, like, time-wise too? Because there are new things coming out all the time.
Yeah. I mean, it was easier back like 10 years ago when there'd be like maybe one new device a year, and that'd be all we'd talk about at like cocktail parties and meetings. But now it's much harder. I think you guys have a you can look at it two ways. It could be like much harder. It could be a positive, because it could be just starting aesthetics. Say you wanted to start an aesthetic practice. One way I could do that now, like if I was starting now and wasn't like back in 2004, you could just start injecting, and you could probably make enough money to like pay your bills injecting. I could inject every day probably. I inject on Fridays. And I love it. It's kind of something I've come back to. I've circled back to. I used to not like it kind of early in my career. I was like, well, I'm a surgeon and I don't want to get. And so, but now I actually like it as more fillers and Botox, more neurotoxins and have come out, tissue biologics. I really enjoy it. You know, the more advanced techniques, of course, but people are more demanding of minimally invasive procedures now, and like more, less downtime, more minimally invasive, less scarring, all that stuff. And so that bred the medical spa culture that we have now. And so it's overwhelming, but to me, what devices, you know, to start with is one, just your own two hands. So maybe you don't buy a device the first year out, but you just start by injecting, right? Mm-hmm. And then maybe you don't have to pay the master of like healthcare insurance companies, and maybe you don't have to contract with them. Wouldn't that be nice if you could just go out into aesthetics and do fee for service and avoid all that stuff? That would be nice, I would think. Now I contracted with insurance companies for the first like 3 years of my career, but like, you know, you get ripped off. You're not paid adequately for your time. And so that's just something to think about. So just starting out with low overhead is important. And then you can build your way up. I mean, I think the way I built up was just starting with a simple, like non-invasive radio frequency device for skin tightening, you know, 38 to 42 degrees Celsius, and fat reduction at 42 to 45 degrees Celsius. There are a lot on the market. And when we started out with Venus Freeze, then it went to Thermi 250. Now we have New Era Tight. So it goes through different iterations, or different companies produce different technology. And I've just gotten, you know, I re-up it and like reboot and get something a little bit more updated every, you know, 2 or 3 years. That's a radio frequency device. And then the next thing I got was a kind of a multifaceted laser. So, you know, Cyton laser. I'm a consultant for them, as a disclaimer, but I bought like a Cadillac laser, the Cyton Jewel. And so I can do BBL, which is like intense pulse light. I can do fractionated laser. I can do micro laser peel, like a very deep resurfacing laser in the operating room. We can do non-invasive vaginal rejuvenation with the Diva, with that as a vaginal probe that we can apply and use it for that. And we do laser hair removal, like everything. It's all in one. Like, so getting one that can do a lot of different tricks is mm-hmm. going to be important. I think you don't necessarily want to put your money into like just one particular service. You'd like to get something early on that's a well-known company that you can invest in, that's going to be like an annuity, and it'll kind of pay itself off. And there's not a lot of consumable cost to that. That's another big piece of the pie, is trying to find something that the manufacturer isn't constantly charging you for. Like every time you use it, we're going to charge you. That, like, try to find something with a low consumable. And a laser, like this particular type of laser I'm talking about, is like that. And so those are the things I started out with. And I was very, in the initial days, I was very careful. I feel like I'm less careful now, but like I go back and I think back, but I was super careful about what device I got and on what timeline, because you have to see that it's working and get a return on the investment. But I don't buy technology I don't believe in, first of all. But there's definitely in this day and age a subset of patients who won't get surgery. They're like, nope, no knife. I run my own PR firm. I absolutely can't have facelift scars. I can't be swollen that long. You have no idea how important I am. So basically, you know, there's a subset of patients that will tell you, And so you present them with options that that really aren't as good as your surgery might do, but they like it, they want it. And so the funny thing is patients will be a little more accepting of, like, say 50% of the result with a non-invasive, but they'd rather have that than undergo surgery. So you have to kind of metabolize that and learn as a surgeon. Again, you're not in control and they don't want you, they want your esthetician to do that. Like, and yeah, so, but basically I'm doing a lot more face than those. So it really ends up being a win-win to have a device that helps to lift the face, because I can send my patients that don't want surgery to my med spa, and my med spa will send facelift clients to me. And so
right.
So it has to kind of mesh with your overall practice dynamic. And, you know, if you do the craniofacial fellowship and you're only going to do facial plastic surgery, it may not make sense to, like, maybe have something that is like laser fat reduction for the hips and the thigh. Like, right. It just may not make sense. Or it may be that it does. It may be that you want to expand your repertoire and your portfolio of patients, and it does.
Mm-hmm. So one thing I thought that was interesting that you mentioned is kind of how you approach patients and how you describe to them, like, the difference between a non-surgical technique and, like, a surgical technique. Because I know people do come in with basically the dichotomy of people who want either no surgery, or they're like, oh, what do you have to offer?
Yeah.
How do you go through the options with them? And do you present it like, this is not going to be as good as surgery?
Yeah. I mean, by the time they reach me, they generally stated an interest in something that I do, meaning my schedulers are the people that are, fortunately for me, the people that pick up my phone at my medical spa. I mean, my medical spa and my surgical center are people that have worked for me for a long time. So they, and we all talk a lot. So basically they're going to be able to channel the patient to the estheticians or the laser technician or mm-hmm. the nurse injector or Dr. Walden, based on what does that patient want? What are their expectations? By the time they reach me, they either want surgery or they're asking for, like, a physician to do their injectables. They want me to be the one to do their injectables, or they maybe want something minimally invasive that the nurse doesn't do, like a thread lift or a PRP, like a vampire facelift. Mm-hmm. All that stuff is very hot right now just because people don't want the surgery, and we can get some nice results in that, like, face tight, neck tight is another example, is a good segue procedure for people who don't need a facelift yet, and they don't want the incisions, but they want some tightening of the lower face and the neck, some contraction. So that's a minimally invasive procedure that only I would perform. It's not delegatable, in other words. So by the time I see them, we're pretty narrowed down, but it's really my schedulers, the people I was talking about that know me, know my practice well, that answer the phone, that are going to put them, they're really good at putting them into the right channels. Mm-hmm. And every now and then we get it wrong. Every now and then patient A will be like, I've been trying to see Dr. Walden a long time, and I don't know, you know, can I get over to her clinic? Every now and then there'll be something like that. That's like where there is a cross wire. But I mean, I think that's just, you know, that's just communication. And I'm willing to see, you know, I'm willing to see patients in the medical spa. I see a lot of patients there that aren't quite there with surgery, and they want to talk Botox, fillers, you know, like, what about a little bit on my nose? Well, why don't you just go ahead and quote me for a closed rhinoplasty anyway?
Right.
And so we get that once they meet you and they see, okay, she's a human, right? She's a human. She can talk to me and all that. Then they warm up to the fact of surgery, and they're like, you know, why don't you just go ahead and quote for the blepharoplasty? You know, I think I may end up doing that this year anyway. And so, but I think they have to get there. You've got to let them get there. And a lot of the med spa patients take a little longer than the surgery patients who show up. The surgery patients usually show up kind of ready to go, that they've done their research. They know the limitations of other procedures. They know they're educated. The medical spa patients are a little more hesitant, reticent to get surgery, maybe not trusting necessarily. And they have to meet you and get to know you. And then all of a sudden you're talking about you've gone into something like you thought was going to be some injectable thing, and you're talking about a closed rhinoplasty, which is fabulous for me. I mean, in my book, that's a home run. You can make a lot of money doing that. I can do injectable, and I'm not trying to make this about money, this podcast, but what I'm trying to say is the ROI of just going and spending a day in my medical spa, it can be equal to the amount of time I'd have done surgery. And there is a lot of liability associated with that surgery I just did to revise the breasts and lift them and all that stuff, right? So revise someone else's work, which, you know, as you get older, you get harder cases too. So I get a lot of cases referred to me. And so I have found like how interesting it is to just walk into a med spa and they hear you do injectables all day, and you like just met whatever you were going to do if you'd done a big lengthy surgery and had to really follow them for the next 50 years. Which is fine. You know, it's fine. That's what we do. But there's more liability associated with it. And I operate a lot. I operate usually like 3 or 4 days a week. I used to do like four days a week or 4.5. And now I'm doing more like 3 because I'm a junior associate, and I'm being the president of the Aesthetic Society. I need time for conference calls and that sort of thing in the mornings and afternoons. So we've blocked out time for me to do that. And then just going back to like work-life balance, you don't want to just be in four walls of an operating room the rest of your life either. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We have a lot of techniques at our disposal. And I think the ability to move gracefully from the operating room to injectables.
Especially for people starting out, it's just something to think about for residents starting out is the opportunity there, you know, what I did in a day, like, so you might not even make that doing surgery at whatever clinic hires you. So just think about that. I think that because you have those techniques at your hands, you know how to do them. And the surgery will come. The surgery comes, as you know, like whether it's, I did you were describing earlier, like taking a little trauma call. I took trauma call at hospitals, all that stuff, and got my boards early. And the aesthetic surgery comes for sure. I mean, it comes early as breast implants and body contouring and lipo. And it comes later in life as eyelids, noses, facelifting. The surgery will come, but if you're injecting this, the surgery really is going to come quicker, like, because those are your clients. Those are the people that are going to operate on them next year, you know, around Christmas time.
Right. Like as you're you become more reputable, like the people that come to you already come in kind of wanting surgery.
At this point in time, and truthfully, it's more of who to turn down, right, than to accept as a surgery client. So I spend a fair amount of time educating my staff on here's what I'm not doing anymore. So like when they call and they ask for X, Y, or Z, we need to educate them and on that, you know, or you need to ask, have you had previous breast surgery before? Like, I'm not doing the revisional breast implant surgery. I'm trying to kind of shift that to my junior associate. Mm-hmm. So I do a lot of revisions in the face. I'd like to concentrate on that. So I do a lot of educating on what we're not doing. And so I think that it comes when you get older and you're able to select more. You can select who you want to do surgery on at this point in time. And so I spend more time kind of like on who we'll pass on. Like we educate the staff on this one, we're going to pass and I'm not going to do that. I don't have the time. I mean, I literally say, you know, if you have someone that's like incredibly high maintenance or that comes across difficult or unrealistic expectations, I'll say literally to my coordinator and my assistant, I don't have the time for it. I just don't have the time that they need, that they'll want. I literally don't. I have to go do that presidency thing. Like, so y'all figure it out, like, amongst yourselves, but I can't do it. We've had these conversations. I'm like, not doing it anymore. So, and I think earlier you might have more time for that, you know, and that's great, but you have to just kind of go with what works for you at what junction in your career and in your life.
Right. Right. And I think that kind of comes back to setting up the practice with medical the people spot. Around yeah. you who know you, who can hear that and help you and like know who's going to fit in your patient population, who's going to want to see you.
Yeah. And I think it comes back also to the medical spa. Like, why is it come back to the medical spa? At the end of the day, if you can generate a passive income source, at the end of the day, the most ultimate peace of mind would be me going home early to see my children, right? Or to see my kids' basketball game or his martial arts tournament. That's the most important thing in my life. Like I said, I'll block those things out on my schedule, but the nicest thing about the medical spa, I mean, you oversee it and you supervise it and you're still very hands-on about it, but it allows you the ability to control your life a little more. And if you need to, you can go home early and you can do those things you wanted to do. And so it's a good day. Dr. Grant Siemens once said, like, he's often like kind of been a coach with the medical spa and aesthetic practice part. And he's told me in the past, like, it's a good day when your medical spa sales eclipse like your surgery day that day when they actually, or for the month, when they actually eclipse each other and your med spa goes over what you were making doing surgery. It's not a sad day. It's a good day. It means you can go travel more. You can spend more time with your kids. And that day has happened. I mean, it happened a while back, but that day's happened. And I just want to, what I try to do is I try to do the surgery that I want to do and I love to do, which is like the facelifting and the rhinoplasty, otoplasty, all that stuff, injectables. But I want to always protect that day. I want to protect the fact that I have a system and a great team in place that are able that, and they like what they do. I mean, obviously I'm not going to keep anybody there against their will. So they all like what they do and they, you know, they get time off and, you know, they rarely get told no. Right. So, they have a good deal, I think, out of it too.
Yeah. I mean that it allows you the freedom, I think, to do what you want, but still maintaining that you can, you know, keep the ship afloat.
And you have to just be, and some people might not want to be a business mind, or maybe their spouse, maybe you have a different setup than I do. Maybe your spouse is a really good business person and you're not so much. And as a team, you could do it together. Like maybe you're listening and you're like, I could never do that because I don't want to mess with lawyers. I don't want to mess with accountants. I want my spouse to do that because that's what she does best, or that's what he does best. And that's okay. But I have to do it all. And that's the hard part is, like I said, it never leaves your cerebral cortex. Then there's constant emails, phone calls. And that's just, I think that's part of being a business owner too. Mm-hmm. But you know, when you have the medical spots, you do have some additional, there's additional stuff you're going to deal with, right? The patients that are unhappy, they didn't meet their expectations. Wants a refund. They thought the fat would be gone by now. And it's like day seven, you know? So it's like, yeah. So there's a lot of patient education and there's quirkiness that you deal with, you know, with patients, the staff. So it's not definitely, it's not like you go home and you can put it away. I think it's good to compartmentalize. We all do as surgeons. I think we have to compartmentalize and try not to take it home and be emotional about if a patient's unhappy with you or a staff member left your practice to go work for someone else. Like, don't take it personally at all. These things happen.
That's amazing advice. So any other advice that you have for, you know, budding aesthetic surgeons or anybody going through training?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's important. I would try to get involved. I mean, here's my plug for the Aesthetic Society is I would just try to get involved early, even though like sometimes it seems like I don't want to pay dues, we make it very easy. As residents and fellows, you can get most benefits are free. We have mentorship programs. We're developing more. We have ASAP or the Aesthetic Society endorsed fellowships, like I think around like 25 of them across the country and all different facets of aesthetic surgery. And those are on our website at theaestheticsociety.org. And we have committee opportunities. So if you're interested in a committee, you can email me at drwalden@theaestheticsociety.org. And I can help you get involved. But I think that helped me a lot. I think getting involved early helped me for sure. It helped pave the way. There's no doubt in my mind. So, because you learn so much from your peers and from those who have been in practice. You learn about business from them. You learn about all sorts of things from them. And you learn about life from them. And so I think just keeping that going. I know a lot of residents are in like the resident program for ASPS, which is great, but just know we also have a resident program that's robust and we're constantly working to be more inclusive and let residents know. Yeah. And there's no like case list required to become a member anymore, no quota, you know. So it's not quite as like exclusive as what it once was, had kind of labeled as being a more exclusive club many years ago, but we're really working on being more inclusive. So I would just say, try to get involved with your professional society early to get to know people in a network and to learn. I mean, the education is bar none better than any aesthetic surgery education you can find anywhere. So
that's awesome. Really appreciate it. And I'm sure you're going to be getting a lot of emails now.
That's right here.
If not just from me, but
yeah. By the way, that's absolutely fine. That's why we do these things.
Yeah.
Pay it forward, right? You pay it forward.
Absolutely. That's a huge part of plastic surgery. That's a huge part of surgical education and just, you know, medical education in general. That's what we try to do here. So thank you for coming and talking with me, sharing so much life advice.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it. It's been lovely.
As a plastic surgeon with a unique vision for each patient, the more options you have at your fingertips, the better. Natrel is one of the portfolios available to you. To learn more, visit natrelsurgeon.com.